Today on Big Biology, we talk with Robert Dudley, who is professor and chair of integrative biology at UC Berkeley. He recently wrote a book in 2014 called The Drunken Monkey, Why We Drink and Abuse Alcohol, published by University of California Press. And in the book, he lays out his what he calls his drunken monkey hypothesis, which searches for deeper evolutionary origins of the relationship between humans and ethanol. His idea focuses on evolutionary and ecological origins of alcohol consumption among primates, and that includes us humans. What we know about changes in alcohol consumption in human populations over the past 10,000 years or so, and what, if anything, an evolutionary perspective provides for understanding alcohol addiction and medical approaches to treating alcohol-related disorders. Robert, welcome to Big Biology. Great to have you on.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
I wanted to start just by asking you how you came to write a book about drinking and alcohol in primates, given your long history of interest in insects and flight.
So I am a primate and I do drink from time to time, but that's not what really motivated my interest in this topic. I have been spending a lot of time in Panama over the last three decades now, and I see a lot of animals and I see a lot of monkeys and I also see a lot of fruit one way or another, even though I'm usually studying insects and hummingbirds. So one day, just, you know, sort of thinking about it, sort of why are we drinking monkey fruit, human alcohol, monkey fruit? And it just sort of clicked that perhaps there's a link via natural fermentation of nutritional substrates that binds primates, which are an ancestrally fruit-eating group, to a selection of fruit in the wild and ultimately to human modern-day drinking behavior.
Mm-hmm. So you frame your book really around the question of why do we humans drink alcohol? And I think to a lot of people, the answer would be like, well, of course, you know, duh, it tastes good. And if we don't drink too much of it, we feel pretty good. That's why we drink. And yet, I mean, I guess to me, that's a pretty shallow answer. And you're sort of after something else about sort of deeper evolutionary reasons for the appeal of alcohol like that. So what's the overall thesis of the book?
Right. Well, we obviously drink because we like to drink, and that's true for many other things we engage in. But that's approximate explanation, and evolutionary biologists like ultimate explanation. So why did we evolve the sensory capacity to taste and, more importantly, enjoy alcohol as opposed to vinegar or any of the other tens of hundreds of thousands of organic compounds? Vintage vinegars, you know, we use it in cooking, but we don't routinely drink vinegar. So, the deeper time perspective is very important because it relates to a broader field of what we now call Darwinian medicine or evolutionary medicine that seeks to place modern day human behaviors and also in some cases pathologies within a more deeply rooted sort of ancestry. And as primates, we enjoy common heritage with apes and various kinds of monkeys in both the old and new world. And it turns out that many of these animals are actually fruit eaters. Primates are ancestrally, going back 25 million years ago, fruit eating animals. And they're also living in the tropics. So one idea, of course, is that if they're consuming fruits because of sugars and lipids, but when you have sugars and even things like nectar, which are, of course, dilute sugar-rich solutions, in the tropics, there are also a lot of yeasts, and yeasts just naturally ferment sugars to produce alcohol. So it may be a commonality of all fruits and nectars in the tropics is that there is actually low-level alcohol present. So all animals that are eating those substrates are actually consuming alcohol.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of our own evolutionary history, I mean, I think of humans as pretty omnivorous and, you know, I myself eat a lot of fruit. I think most of us do, but we're not pure fruit eaters. So how long ago did our ancestors have a mostly fruit diet?
So if we go back and look at the apes more broadly, so we can start with the gibbons, about 24 species, and move on to the orangutans, and then the gorillas, and of course the chimpanzees, our nearest relatives. And we diverged about 4 or 5 million years ago from the least, or the most common recent ancestor of chimpanzees and ourselves. Going back even 2 million years in the evolution of the genus Homo, there was a predilection toward fruit consumption. And we know this from dentition, from dental remains. We know this from various paleoanthropological studies of environments and just other aspects of the biology of these animals.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about that association. So why is it that fruits themselves produce alcohol, and why is that associated with nutrition and calories from sugar?
So fruits derive from flowering plants, otherwise known technically as angiosperms, and they are engaged in an evolutionary mutualism with animal consumers. So many fruits are not dispersed by wind, but rather they are dispersed by animals, which consume the fruit, and then either in their gut or just via past sort of throwing off the seeds, effect translation in space as, say, dispersal for the benefit of the plant. So this, in these mutualistic arrangements, it's important for both participants to have a benefit, otherwise it won't evolve. And the benefit provided by the plants to the animals is nutrition. And usually, if you think about sugary, rich, gooey sort of tropical fruits like mangoes or pineapples or any of the hundreds of other kinds of species, and there are literally thousands of kinds of fruits in the tropics, they have pulp. And within that pulp is mostly sugar. It's actually a lot of water, but there's sugar, there are structural carbohydrates, in some cases there are lipids as well, fats. But animals consume all of these compounds with relish. So if you have sugars in aqueous environments, and you can do this at home, of course, by adding sugar to water and a little bit of yeast, and you will generate alcohol. The yeasts are actually producing it, of course, not the plants. But it's an inevitable consequence of having the carbohydrates, so those low molecular weight sugars like glucose, fructose, sucrose present within water, you do need the yeast to participate. And it turns out yeast spores are everywhere. They're everywhere on plants. They're in the air, particularly in tropical environments. They land on fruits. They even land on flowers before flowers turn into fruits. And sometimes you might have had the experience of opening up an avocado. It looks great, and it's rotten from the inside out. That's because of the fungal spores were actually deposited at the floral stage. So the yeasts are everywhere. Sugars are within fruit. Yeast ferment sugar to produce ethanol. And that is a ubiquitous cue then to any animal, both over long distance to smell alcohol. It'll tell you where the sugar is, but also over short distance to kind of like get a better heady sort of brew and odor, like lets you decide which fruits might be best to eat, which is the ripe fruit. So you're only going to get this outcome when you've got sugars within and available to for consumption.
And what do you expect are the sort of highest levels that fruits would attain? I guess fruits that are being eaten by primates, right? That's the key question.
Exactly. So we did this set of measurements on palm fruits in Panama that we know white-faced monkeys and spider monkeys and some other monkeys and a lot of other mammals are eating. And using my a priori initial characterization of fruits as ripe, in other words, they look like they're suitable for consumption, the average value was 0.5% of the fruit pulp, which doesn't sound like very much. But these animals can eat up to 10% of their body weight a day in fruit because they are dedicated fruit eaters. So it's not just the concentration of what you're drinking, but how much you drink of it that determines the overall dosage. Mm-hmm. But we did get some over what I thought of as, or characterized a priori as, overripe fruits, which are as high as 8% alcohol. And it's really tasty stuff. You know, it's like, this is really nice, rich palm fruit pulp. So
you try it yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Are you kidding? Yeah, it's good stuff. Yeah.
So we want to get back to humans here pretty soon. But since you brought it up, I want to ask about mechanisms of drunkenness. So what is it in, you know, some non-technical way that ethanol does inside our bodies that makes us drunk?
Unlike all other psychoactive drugs that humans consume recreationally, ethanol has no specific receptor or binding molecule. So there are no ethanol receptors on particular neurons in our brain. Instead, it acts much more broadly on the central nervous system, and it's not entirely clear what the effects of the ethanol are, other than to change what's called membrane fluidity, basically how cell membranes are sort of composed and can move, and more importantly, can allow other proteins and other receptor molecules embedded within those membranes to move relative to one another. So it's a very broad-acting molecule, and what's kind of interesting is just to think that, well, maybe it is the original drug in the sense, you know, it is psychoactive. And the argument of the drunken monkey hypothesis is that the psychoactive properties are beneficial in the context of feeding on fruit. So basically, it's what psychologists call hedonic reward. So consumption of ethanol stimulates further consumption of the ethanol-containing substrate. So when you get to ripe fruit crop in the tropics, consume as much as you can. You binge consume to prevent others from getting it. You know, so there's a lot of competition. The microbes are already there that you feed until your gut fills up. And animals don't get drunk in the wild most of the time because their gut fills and they satiate before they can get high level of ethanol reward. So there's just a much more broad acting basis for ethanol effects in the central nervous system of mammals. But interestingly enough, some of the there are pathways called dopaminergic pathways, which are involved in the regulation of feeding behavior, which are similarly stimulated indirectly via alcohol consumption. So it may be that somehow ethanol is piggybacked onto these reward pathways in our brain for historical evolutionary reasons were actually very beneficial. But now we have high concentration, high availability alcohol. It's like with high sugar availability, high fats availability, things can go badly wrong.
And Robert, you mentioned a few other potentially adaptive benefits of alcohol consumption. I wonder if you want to say anything about that in terms of, you know, protection against microbes in a direct way and lifespan, those types of things.
Yeah. So ethanol is a microbicide. And going back to the 19th century, there were cardiologists and doctors then and cardiologists now have noticed that low-level ethanol consumption seems to be protective against cardiovascular risk relative to either high-level consumption or no consumption. So this is what epidemiologists call a nonlinear dosage response curve, that there's kind of a sweet spot in the middle for consumption of certain things. And that's true for heavy metals, that's true for vitamins, that's true for a lot of things. But this is something that animals are sort of routinely exposed to if they're drinking nectar or consuming fruit. At least that's the hypothesis. So what this argues, and there's a jargony word called hormesis, which suggests it's this nonlinear dosage response curve that suggests that if you are evolutionarily exposed to something at low concentrations, you evolve the capacity to metabolize it, but also benefit from it relative to abnormally high concentrations on the one hand or to its absence on the other. So that concept of beneficial effects of low-level chronic routine alcohol consumption has been eminently borne out by about 40 years of hardcore epidemiology looking at cardiovascular risk and controlling for all other kinds of things. So there are definitely some benefits, and the mechanism has actually been figured out. Ethanol interferes with formation of atherosclerotic plaques in coronary arteries, and which is a primary, you know, pathway for cardiac disease. And there's secondary evidence suggesting that the initial formation of those plaques is by bacteria, which, of course, would be susceptible to ethanol as a microbicide. So it may actually ultimately, in modern-day humans, the beneficial effects of low-level drinking may link back to the ancient association between yeasts, fruits, and bacteria. So ethanol being a microbicide. That's one of the possible benefits. But you get the same result for fruit flies if you expose them to low-level alcohol. You can increase lifespan of fruit flies.
I've got a follow-up question, too, about ethanol as a microbicide. So I think your implication is that blood alcohol levels are high enough to have antimicrobial activity. So is there any evidence that they do?
So in humans, the epidemiology shows that not just consumption of ethanol, but particularly consumption of ethanol in association with food provides cardiovascular benefit. And if you ask, where are the microbial contaminants? And we're riddled with infections. Most of them never go anywhere. But our mouths, obviously, are a major source of bacteria. So alcohol ingestion with food may actually be intimately sort of commingling bacterial contaminants with a microbicide.
Oh,
so
that's one
possibility. Yeah.
So you're talking about killing microbes in the mouth, not killing them after they're already in the bloodstream and associated with plaques.
Nobody really knows. So those kinds of studies, as far as I've been able to discern, have ever been done. So it's not quite clear where the mechanism of action might be. So these are, the epidemiology is all correlational. It's retrospective. It's not prospective intervention. So we don't know exactly, you know, you can't do it experimentally on humans, but it's been done experimentally on fruit flies and on rodents, lab rodents, and you get the same result. There's something nice about low-level alcohol on a daily basis as opposed to zero abstention or really high levels. Mm-hmm. And this is not a public health prescription to go out and drink more ethanol, of course, because, you know, has to be calibrated against family background. It's sex specific because females have, the curves are different for men and women. It also depends a little bit on genetic background. There are interesting genetic variants amongst modern day humans in the capacity to degrade ethanol. Most famous of these is, of course, the East Asian facial flush or red flush phenomenon. So many East Asians, however you define that, and it's kind of arbitrary, but mostly Han Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, about 80% of those populations have a very slow-acting enzyme to degrade ethanol. And they get sick when they drink even very tiny amounts of alcohol. So as a consequence, they tend not to drink at all. So historically, rates of alcoholism have been claimed to be much lower in East Asia than in the rest of the world because they can't metabolize ethanol, so they don't drink. But if you even look within East Asian populations, the people who are locally classified as alcoholics are 10 times more likely to have the fast-acting version of these enzymes. Hmm. So they can metabolize ethanol. It doesn't ensure that they will become addicted to ethanol, however you define addiction, but it just means the potential is there. There's strong genetic underpinnings, and that suggests that there's been selection just even in the last 10,000 years on modern-day humans and the capacity to metabolize alcohol. We know that's true for fruit flies. There's lots of alcohol metabolizing variants. But even in modern day humans, and also actually across the great apes, we know that about 12 million years ago, there was a dramatic change, an increase by a factor of 20 in the ability of these animals to degrade ethanol. And that seems to have correlated with terrestrialization. They go bipedal, they're on the ground more. The inference or hypothesis is that they're obtaining greater access to fruits that are on the ground that have been sitting around and fermenting. So there's greater dietary exposure and there's been selection for a better capacity to degrade ethanol. That's hypothetical, but it's a possibility. But there is a signature in the genome of ancestral exposure to alcohol, even in all modern day primates, so including ourselves.
So Robert, what about modern human populations? I mean, do you have ideas about why human populations are different with respect to their capacity to metabolize? I mean, where do these variants come from in the populations you were referring to before?
So the East Asian variants have been actually well characterized since the 1970s, but only have been recently dated using molecular clocks to the origins of rice domestication. They're new. They're like 10,000 years old, which sounds like a lot, but it's actually very new and recent compared to the age of our species. So there's no good explanation as to why in East Asia and only in East Asia do you find these slow-acting variants. Well, one hypothesis, of course, is it's protective against alcoholism, however you define alcoholism. That's a possibility. Another one involves a third participant, like the sickle cell anemia or other kinds of arguments, is that in stored rice products and grain products, there are fungal toxins, mycotoxins, and that somehow the intermediate metabolic chemistry of alcohol degradation in these East Asian populations is protective against these mycotoxins. So that there's been selection for these, what's called acetaldehyde formation in the pathway of alcohol degradation, that somehow having greater acetaldehyde concentrations, it makes you averse to alcohol, but it is protective against mycotoxins. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in terms of human domestication of crops and origins of controlled fermentation, Patrick McGovern at the University of Pennsylvania has made a beautiful career in the field he created called molecular archaeology, whereby he goes to or museums and archaeological sites throughout the Near East, but also more recently in China. And there are, by scraping out, in essence, residues on what are thought to have been fermentation vessels and ceramics and other kinds of things, there are very specific molecular markers for the presence of fermented plant compounds. And you can actually get very specific taxonomic identification of the kinds of fruits that are used. So for a long time, people had always said the Near East was the origin of domestication and origin of wine. And that's probably true, but it's probably not. It might be more in sort of parts of Iran, rather modern day Iran, rather than Iraq and so on. But then they found that the earliest unambiguous archaeological evidence for intentional fermentation is actually in central China. And it pushed it back to about, I think, about 10,000 years BC, something like that.
And what were they fermenting?
Hawthorn berries, amongst other things. So they didn't have nice domesticated fat grapes then, but there is a lot of fruit and a lot of other things. So it turns out that ancient beers and wines had many more ingredients and different kinds of ingredients than what we use today. So Patrick has actually partnered with a brewery on the East Coast to recreate many of these ancient brews. And they're very different and they're very tasty. You know, it's just a question of what you like and what you're exposed to. So it's there's a broader hypothesis out there is that the origins of domesticated crops are as much about grain and fruit storage for the purposes of generating alcohol as they are for long-term storage of carbohydrates. So in other words, that fermenting is a way of preserving grains and fruits because alcohol is a microbicide. And in fact, if you go to parts of Africa or the Indian subcontinent, many times people will drink it's a combination of eating and drinking a fermented millet or sorghum kind of paste. So it's neither liquid nor solid, but it's a fermented product of agriculture. So that would have been an easy way if you had grains, an incipient domestication of grains and fruits and things like that. You just throw it all into a big vessel and you just store it there and it starts to ferment and you consume some and you add in more substrate. And that may have been as important to the origins of domestication of crops as was, say, bread making or any of the other more classical ideas. So we have a long, tight history with alcohol.
That's a pretty good segue into what are we going to do with this information? I mean, the drunken monkey hypothesis, I personally find fascinating, but you know, I've been indoctrinated a long time ago. I've been teaching evolutionary medicine for years. There's a lot of skeptics out there, as you know, about just the tenets of evolutionary medicine generally, and they come from a bunch of different perspectives. But what have been your responses? And I mean, I guess the argument about the environment being different now than it was, being able to get lots of concentrated stuff fairly readily, that's a big part of it. But knowing that, or knowing what, having this hypothesis for the drunken monkey, what are we going to do to change our behavior to minimize alcoholism?
Yeah, I think one way to think about it is to realize that it is an attraction to alcohol may be a general feature of sensory biology of primates. It's not something you can turn off very easily. And that's true for drive for calories more generally. You can't just prohibit consumption of calories, prohibit consumption of alcohol. That doesn't work as a public policy sort of prescription. Instead, you have to think more broadly about, even though people do engage in sometimes self-destructive behavior, how can you mitigate the exposure and mitigate the consequences of that behavior? So taxation, for example, cigarette smoking incidence was reduced dramatically over the last 3 or 4 decades. So for whatever reasons that people might smoke cigarettes, there are effective public policy sort of things that can be done to limit the damage, the negative effects of cigarettes. So too with alcohol consumption, maybe in terms of, you know, just the recognition that it is, it's not an aberrancy or a novelty, that it is like, it's like the drive for sugars and fats, that it's maybe it is truly a part of the feature of our biology, that that can potentially influence sort of ways that we might try to regulate or control the negative aspects of it. You know, there have been arguments that because of the cardiovascular protective benefits of low-level alcohol consumption, to put health advisory labels on wine and beer promoting consumption of alcohol, right? Because it's a positive thing. That's a kind of a inverse argument. But at the same time, we don't really know much about what regulates the transition from kind of, we'll call it responsible drinking, to excessive consumption. So I think, you know, there's no just knowing where things came from doesn't necessarily tell us how we can treat sort of subsets of the deleterious or negative behavior. But the historical context is always going to be relevant for things like sickle cell anemia and a lot of other sorts of features. If you really just want to understand it, doesn't explain how to solve some of the addictive disorders, but just to try to understand what is addiction more generally. So I think just trying to understand the basis of the attraction to alcohol, ultimately one would hope would lead to a better sort of set of treatments and possibly a cure for the disease.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Rob. I really appreciate it. And
this is great.
I have one last question.
Sure.
What are you going to drink tonight for dinner?
Oh, what do I have lined up? We have a Cabernet Sauvignon already open. That's just going to add a party on the weekend. So I 1 to 2 glasses a day just to be on the safe side, but nothing to excess.
You got to protect your health.
Everything in moderation. Yeah, that's
right. So. There you go.
Okay, guys. See you later.
All right. Thanks a lot, Robert. Take care.
Bye. Special thanks to Matt Blois for editing and production help. Thanks also to Gerard Seppes, Romain Boisseau, Devin O'Brien, Steve Lane, Victoria Doloff, Haley Hansen, Holly Kilvitis, Travis Flock, Meredith Kernbach, Chloe Ramsey, Jeff Olberding, Laura Schoenley, Cynthia Downs, and Suzanne Miller.